Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you'll hear from our expert speakers. We will now allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Nicole, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, and today's program is Update on the Treatment of Bladder Cancer. And this is really a program that we would love to do more often. It's an important topic, and I know from your response to this topic that it's an important one for all of you on the call today. And so so stay tuned. We'll try to do it a little bit more often than we do. Usually once a year we've been offering it. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And I also particularly want to call out the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, or BCAN, who've been really instrumental in helping to spread the word about the program, as have other groups as well, but they particularly have helped out to spread the word. And so we have on the program today over 692 participants. So there are a lot of you on the call today. You can't see each other, but you're all there. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Canada, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So really, it's a global call, and you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker is Dr. Amishi Shah. Dr. Shah is Assistant Professor, Genitourinary Medical Oncology, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Shah is going to be addressing overview of bladder cancer, including staging and grading, standard of care, the role of diagnostic technologies and precision medicine, emerging role of immunotherapy, and she'll also be addressing new treatment approaches and clinical trials, targeted treatments, predicting response to treatment, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. So she's going to be covering a lot of topics, and we are delighted to have Dr. Shah on the call today, and it really is my pleasure now to turn this program over and to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. It's an absolute delight and a privilege to be able to do this. So bladder cancer, also known as urothelial cancer, makes up about 80,000 cases a year in the United States and about 5% of all new cancer cases. You'll hear the term urothelial cancer oftenly used, and what that refers to is the urothelial cells, which are the type of cells that line the inside of the bladder as well as the ureters, which are the tracts that connect the kidney to the bladder. So urothelial cancer is the most common type of bladder cancer. It's sort of the most common variant seen, but there are other histologic subtypes that are seen, and so if your doctor suggests you have a rare subtype, you may hear words such as squamous cell, plasmacytoid, micropapillary. Those are all much less common histologies, and typically you will hear the words urothelial cancer. In terms of staging, I'll kind of go into this very broadly and not into too much of the nitty-gritty, but the sort of treatment algorithms are basically dependent on whether you're in one of three categories. Patients that have very superficial disease are patients that have cancer only affecting the very inner lining of the bladder, and it has not gotten anywhere further into the muscle of the bladder. The bladder is surrounded by a thick wall of muscle. As you can imagine, it helps the bladder to contract. And when those tumor cells start to invade into the muscle is where that cancer can start to get a little more advanced and require a little additional therapy to treat it. And then the third stage we think about sort of broadly is in the metastatic setting. And what that means is that basically cancer cells have spread outside the bladder area or urinary tract into distant areas in the body such as lymph nodes or other organs. Now, in terms of the standard of care treatment for superficial cancers, as I first mentioned, which are cancers that are specifically only on the inner lining of the bladder and not invading any deeper, typically the treatment is very localized treatment. The urologist can go in, usually resect the tumor. There may be a role for some intravesicular chemotherapy, which means basically just in the bladder, where they're, you know, infusing different agents into the bladder area in an attempt to kill any remaining cells. And typically it's something where you would need to get a repeat cystoscopy to look in at the area. That is different than patients who have muscle-invasive bladder cancer. This is the scenario in which those cancer cells have started to invade into the muscle tissue of the bladder or even further to the fat surrounding the bladder. In those scenarios, typically the standard of care is neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by surgery. And what the term neoadjuvant means is basically chemotherapy that's offered prior to surgical resection. Now, we all consider surgery to be a very heavy lifter in the treatment of bladder cancer, but the chemotherapy part is important in that it helps to downsize the tumor prior to surgery, as well as get rid of any microscopic disease that might have escaped the bladder area. For a patient that may not be a surgical candidate, sometimes our patients are a little bit older or frailer with comorbid medical conditions. If they're not a candidate for surgery, they may be offered a combination of chemotherapy and radiation, and that is also considered standard of care. In terms of the metastatic setting, which is, again, where the cancer cells have escaped the bladder to go to other places in the body, typically we rely on what are called systemic therapies, meaning therapies that go all over the body, usually intravenously, so that they're hitting all sites of disease. And options in the metastatic setting include chemotherapies as well as immunotherapies, which I'll go into more detail about later. Traditionally, chemotherapies had been the mainstay. However, just in the last 2 years, there's been an explosion of new therapies in the immunotherapy world, and so that has really sort of changed our management in the metastatic setting. In terms of sort of the workup and the role of diagnostic technologies and precision medicine, it really depends on what stage a patient is initially at. So if something is very superficial, they may just require cystoscopies, urine samples, and blood work. However, as things start to get a little more advanced, you may require increased imaging studies such as a CAT scan, particularly to the chest, making sure that nothing has spread, the abdomen and pelvis to look at the lymph nodes. In the metastatic setting, if we're worried about bony involvement of disease, your physician may order a bone scan, or if there's any concern for development of cancer in the brain, they might need a brain MRI. And so those are the imaging therapies that are often used, or excuse me, imaging modalities that are often used in sort of the workup in bladder cancer. And then another key piece is really this urologic assessment that I've referred to. So a cystoscopy is basically where a urologist takes a camera to look up in the bladder, and sometimes they may even need to go a little bit further up into the ureters that drain to the bladder to take a look at the sites. Now, a urologic assessment has multiple things that they're looking at, and one of the key pieces is sort of their ability to resect the tumor. So that's what's called a transurethral resection of bladder tumor. And so that is the way that the urologists are able to get tissue to help with diagnosis. Another part of their assessment is also what's called an exam under anesthesia. This is not done everywhere, but when done, it's sort of an important piece of the puzzle because essentially a urologist assesses by manual palpation whether it feels like the cancer has gotten into the muscle and fat layers of the bladder. And that can be a very helpful assessment in understanding how really important chemotherapy is or is not in the care of a particular patient. As I mentioned before, the role of chemotherapy prior to surgery is really in part to help downsize the tumor. And so if we feel that the tumor has gotten into muscle or fat layers, that chemotherapy becomes that much more important prior to getting a patient to surgery in order to sort of maximize their outcomes. I'm going to go into a little bit of detail on immunotherapy at this point. That's sort of really a very hot topic in oncology, and it's people come every single day into my clinic asking about medications they've seen ads for on TV or how this plays into their cancer treatment. So within the last year, the FDA has approved 5 new immunotherapy drugs for the treatment of urothelial cancer. Now, there is some slight differences between the drugs, and they act at two different receptors, all the five drugs that have been approved. But bottom line is that they are relatively similar with some very minor variations. So they're not five different, completely different, dramatically different therapies. They're very, very similar. And so it's somewhat dealer's choice. It doesn't, you know, I'll go into a little bit of the data of how we kind of make those decisions. But typically, any one of these immunotherapies can be a good choice in the setting of metastatic bladder cancer. So the way these immunotherapy drugs work is that we all have a very fine system of checks and balances with our immune system. So in a healthy, normal patient, as you can imagine, when you come up with a cold or cough or a bug, your immune system cells pick up the invader. They pick up, for example, a bacterial, you know, protein that might be causing a pneumonia, and basically take that to your immune cells and say, hey, this is a foreign particle. It's not supposed to be here, and let's activate a response against it. In response to that, your immune system ramps up, and it goes off to kill the foreign cells, and that's how you get over a cold or cough or infection. Now, your immune system naturally also has ways of shutting down that response. So you've probably all heard of autoimmune conditions like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. That's a situation in which the immune system is overactive, in which it's too active. So your body has natural checkpoints where it says, okay, it's time to calm the immune system down. It's been fighting this particular particle for a while, and I don't want it to do damage to any normal tissue, so let me shut it down. So that's a normal response to shut down the immune system after some time. So how does that work in cancer treatment? Well, your body is smart enough to recognize those cancer cells as foreign. Your body will pick up on the fact that it is a outside entity, it's not a self cell, and it will take that to immune system to activate against it. So your immune system will activate against those tumor cells, but then you remember that at some point your immune system will say, okay, time to calm down. We don't want to damage any normal tissue. What these drugs do, the new immunotherapy drugs do, is that they basically allow the immune system to continue to activate against the tumor cells. It shuts down those natural checkpoints and stopping points that your immune system has so that your body can continue to attack those cancer cells. And that is the concept behind how they work. Now, the reason people have been so excited is sort of twofold. For one, it's a completely different strategy than what we've had in the past for cancer treatment. What we've had traditionally in bladder cancer are what are called cytotoxic chemotherapies. The immunotherapies work in a completely different mechanism, as I mentioned, so they have a completely different side effect profile as well. So this is not like your traditional chemotherapy where, you know, people may lose their hair, they have nausea or vomiting, they might have a higher risk of infection. These immunotherapies don't carry those traditional side effects, but they do carry a different profile of side effects, particularly where we need to be very careful for monitoring for autoimmune type of events. You remember I just mentioned immunotherapies allow your immune system to be more active, and so we monitor very closely for autoimmune type phenomenon, things like rashes or diarrhea or changes in some of your blood work like liver function tests or hormone levels. Now, the other exciting part about immunotherapy is that for those people who respond, they seem to have a very prolonged response or a longer duration of disease control. Now, I will say that, you know, a lot of my patients will come, and if I have potentially recommended chemotherapy, they may say, well, can I have immunotherapy instead? And I will say I think there's a role for both therapies in particular situations, but that right now, immunotherapy has not replaced completely the traditional therapies we have at hand. The reason I say that is that a less percent of patients respond to immunotherapies than our traditional chemotherapies. Now, as I mentioned, those that do respond seem to have a very nice prolonged response, but immunotherapy does not work for everyone. So I do not want people to come away feeling like it's the absolute best option and nothing else will do, because there's still very much a role for our traditional chemotherapies in this setting, since not everybody responds to immunotherapy. Now, going on to sort of new treatment approaches in clinical trials, I'll give a little background on clinical trials first. So the goal of clinical trials in medicine is really to improve upon the standard of care. How can we do better than what we're doing now? How can we move the field forward? How can we improve survival? And so it really is trying to improve upon what we currently know. Clinical trials are done in a very closely monitored setting. There is an enormous amount of regulation and oversight that goes into any clinical trial. So rest assured that anything that's done would be very closely monitored, not just by the place you're being treated, but by external agencies, including the FDA as well. The plus for patients on clinical trials is that they often have early access to drugs that might not otherwise be available. These are drugs that have shown some promise in early studies, and we're trying to bring it to a new setting and give patients earlier access to these drugs while we study them in a very monitored setting to see if it is indeed something that can improve what we currently know and do. Most clinical trials are run at academic centers. However, it's becoming more and more frequent that certain private practice groups may run them, and so really, a quick Google search will often yield results for you in terms of what clinical trials are going on near you. There are obviously logistical concerns for every patient, and everybody is different, but if given the opportunity, one thing to remember is that you are not, a lot of my patients will ask me, well, what if I get the placebo arm? Meaning, what if I don't get the exciting new therapy and I just get placebo? One thing I can promise you is that on most clinical trials, you will get the standard of care or better. So if you are in a clinical trial that we know a particular drug works, then you would be in a situation where it's being compared to the traditional therapy. So you're never going to get something that you're never going to be denied a therapy that we think would be helpful in a situation by engaging in a clinical trial. In terms of sort of new drugs that are up and coming, I mentioned the five new immunotherapy drugs, and a lot of clinical trials that are ongoing currently, especially in the United States, include combinations of chemotherapies and immunotherapies or combinations of targeted therapies and immunotherapies. Because the immunotherapies can be well tolerated and because we are finding ways to sort of modulate the immune system to get better effects, the combination therapy, I suspect, will be the way of the future, but the jury is still out on that. We're just starting to learn about these combinations. And we're learning a lot from other tumor types, too. So, for example, many of the immunotherapy drugs that are approved are also used in other cancer types. And so, for example, in lung cancer, there was just a very big sort of seminal piece of work done in which the combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy really improved upon response rates in lung cancer patients. And so similar studies are being done in the bladder world, and right now that's not the standard of care. So we will see what comes of those studies, but as we learn that information, the standard of care may change. Now, I'll go into just a little bit of detail on those immunotherapies. The most commonly used therapies are basically therapies that are anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1, and those refer to specific immune proteins that are activated in sort of immune checkpoints in our system, in our bodies. The two drugs that target PD-1 are pembrolizumab or Keytruda and nivolumab or Opdivo. The other three drugs are PD-L1 inhibitors. We do not have data comparing the PD-L1 agents to the PD-1 agents directly. However, there is a sense that the PD-1 agents may have some slightly higher activity than the PD-L1 agents. So at our center, we are using the pembrolizumab and nivolumab more often than the other agents, though that is certainly not a wrong option. The strongest data is probably with pembrolizumab, Keytruda, because that drug has been tested in a phase 3 clinical trial, which basically means they compared pembrolizumab directly with a traditional chemotherapy that is used in the second line setting. And it was found that pembrolizumab had a superior survival advantage and tolerability over the traditional chemotherapy in what's called the second line metastatic setting. And I'm happy to go into more detail about that in the question and answer. But pembrolizumab is the only drug with a proven survival advantage in a phase 3 study to date. So while that data is the strongest, we do feel like the efficacy of all 5 drugs are pretty similar, and it is somewhat dealer's choice. So like I said, none of them is a wrong answer, just the pembrolizumab has the most data and patient numbers to sort of support that. Moving on to targeted treatments, this is sort of another hot topic in oncology of pairing a therapy with a patient based on specific alterations or molecular changes we may see in that individual. So it's sort of the concept of precision medicine or individualized medicine. Now, certainly, I think this field will continue to change in the years to come. It's not perfect at this time, but what is done frequently in bladder cancer is, especially in the metastatic setting, physicians will often send off molecular panels looking for mutations or alterations in a particular patient. There are many commercial laboratories that do this. There are also, private ones that individual academic centers may do. So, for example, at MD Anderson, we send off a particular internal molecular panel, and it may come back, say, on a patient showing 3 particular mutations. So I would look at that for my patient and say, okay, do we have any drugs that target one of these mutations, and is it something we want to consider as a treatment option? Now, I will say I do not think at this moment that molecular panel testing and therapy targeting those should replace the standard of care. Where I use it is if somebody has had chemotherapy and immunotherapy and either had some response but not complete response or have progressed on those therapies, that's where the targeted treatments come into a little bit more play. So they do not replace the standard of care. But for example, say a patient came back with a particular alteration, such as FGFR. Well, I would look and say, oh, well, we have an FGFR drug that targets that specific mutation, and let me see if that's an option for my patient in terms of treatment to try and target their specific alteration. Now, a lot of times when we send these molecular panels, we do have to be prepared that there may be mutations found that we don't have a drug for at this time. It may be something that something becomes available for in the future, but occasionally we find that it is just information, but we don't have an actual drug that targets it. Other times, patients come back with no mutations detected at all on that particular panel, and so it isn't something that can help guide a treatment decision at that point in time. A lot of my patients will often ask me, okay, well, how do you predict the response to my treatment? And this is also very much an evolving field, and we could probably spend all day talking about some of these nuances. One of the tests you may frequently see if you look it up on the internet or even if your doctor may mention it is a test called PD-L1. And this is looking at somebody's expression of a particular PD-L1 protein and trying to figure out if it suggests that they're more able to or more likely to get a response from one of the immunotherapy drugs. I can tell you this is a very controversial topic because it has really been different across different tumor types. So, for example, in lung cancer, there are certain drugs that are only approved for patients, certain immunotherapy drugs that are only approved for patients that have a high PD-L1 expression. That has really not panned out in the bladder world quite as clearly. So all 5 immunotherapies are actually approved regardless of how much PD-L1 a patient expresses. Now, we have some sense that somebody with a high PD-L1 expression might have a better response to immunotherapy, but we've actually seen responses across all sort of ranges. And so even if somebody has a low PD-L1, it does not necessarily mean they're not going to respond to immunotherapy. So I don't even routinely test it all the time, because if I think somebody may benefit or they're a candidate for it, we just don't have a perfect sense of how that PD-L1 plays into it. So interesting information. I think it will evolve in the future, but I wouldn't hang my hat on that particular number for an individual patient. What I also tell patients is the best test is really the test of time. How one particular individual is going to respond to a therapy, nobody knows. We have our biologic rationale for trying something, but the best test is really to see what happens on your next set of scans or at your next assessment if things have changed or shrunk or grown. That's really the best test of what your individual biology is doing and what that drug is doing in a particular patient. also upcoming, this is sort of in the future, but we think there are certain chemotherapies that will make people more sensitive to immunotherapies, and so there's some sense that maybe we'll be able to predict better responses by priming the immune system. But again, that's sort of all still in the works and not quite ready for prime time. The last thing I want to touch on, and potentially the most important thing, is sort of quality of life concerns as you're undergoing treatment. And this is a really important topic to me because it's really all about communication with your healthcare provider and your whole team. One of the key considerations when thinking about quality of life concerns is what is the intent of your treatment? So in oncology, this is a very fundamental question for us. For every patient, one of the first things we assess is this patient being treated with curative intent or palliative intent? And what that means is if a patient is being treated with curative intent, that means whatever therapies we're offering, be it chemo, surgery, immunotherapy, we're doing it with the goal of curing them so their cancer goes away and never comes back. That's a very different conversation than a patient who's being treated with palliative intent. And what palliative intent means is, okay, this is a scenario in which the cancer is not curable. It has spread to other areas in the body, and we don't have anything that can make it go away 100%, but we're offering therapy with the hopes of improving symptoms, improving quality of life or maintaining quality of life, and also prolonging survival with a meaningful quality of life. And so one of the first things I always think about is that in any given patient, because your threshold for sort of side effects and toxicities of treatment is going to be different in those two settings. So if I'm treating a patient with palliative intent, meaning my goal is to improve their quality of life, knowing I may not be able to cure their cancer, well, then any side effects that are coming up, that's very important for me to address with, because what the last thing I want to do is knock someone further down with therapy than they would have felt otherwise. Then, you know, you're not really meeting that goal of palliating symptoms if the therapy is making them feel worse than the cancer. So really, in quality of life concerns, I think it's all about being very clear with your provider of, okay, you know, this is a side effect that's occurring. Or for example, I'm having diarrhea, but it's totally manageable if I take an Imodium, versus I'm having this diarrhea and it's affecting everything I'm doing. I can't go out and do my normal day-to-day activities because of it. Can you please help troubleshoot this? And that's really important for us to know so that we can make sure we're addressing those. We've gotten a lot better in this day and age at dealing with quality of life issues and symptom management than we used to. There are all kinds of new drugs for, you know, nausea and vomiting and interventions that we can make for patients that are having side effects. We just need to know about them so that we can actually help. So I think that's a very important piece. And then the other, you know, you'll hear later in this conference from sort of resources that cancer patients have, but I think it's really important for patients to remember that it's not just their doctor that they have. They usually have a whole care team, and most cancer centers or places that treat cancer will have different groups you can reach out to, like physical therapy, nutrition, integrative medicine, and those are also fantastic resources in dealing with sort of quality of life issues that come with cancer care. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Mesner, and I'm happy to go into any more detail on any of these topics during the question and answer. Thank you very much again for having me.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shah. That was a tour de force, really wonderfully presented and really covering the whole scope of the issues, and I know there will be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Stephanie Chisholm, and Dr. Chisholm is Director of Education and Research, Bladder Cancer Advocacy, or BCAN. And Dr. Chisholm is going to be addressing Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network's, BCAN's, free programs and services, and it's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chisholm.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It was very nice, Dr. Shah. That was a wonderful overview of so many aspects of treating bladder cancer and so many issues that patients have concerns about. And since 2005, the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network has really been the only nonprofit patient advocacy group specifically dedicated to advancing bladder cancer research and supporting individuals who might be impacted by the disease. And we know that a lot of bladder cancer patients, it really becomes a family disease because there's so many consequences associated with it. And just to give you a quick highlight, I'd love for everyone to visit our brand new website, www.bcan.org. bcan.org, where you will find all levels of information about your diagnosis, about the different treatment options, as well as the ability to sign up for our Bladder Cancer Basics, which is a complete comprehensive little booklet handbook for patients to understand their disease. You can also sign up for specific bladder cancer patient insight webinars. And one of the most significant things that we have that I think is a great resource is this is such a unique disease that it really does help to speak with somebody who really has walked the walk and gone through the journey. And our Survivor to Survivor and Beacon Connection programs allow you to actually do that, to actually speak with someone who is matched with age and gender and going through the similar types of treatment so that you have a chance to talk to somebody and they can help you understand the kinds of questions they wish that they had known when they were diagnosed and give you somebody to talk to who really knows what the journey is all about. We also support bladder cancer research and have an annual scientific meeting that's specifically focused just on bladder cancer, and I believe it's the only one in North America. So anything else, Carolyn?
Well, that's terrific. Well, thank you so much. That's a wonderful presentation and also wonderful to partner with you on this program because, indeed, you are the unique bladder cancer organization in the country, perhaps internationally, and to some extent it's been wonderful to have that partnership with you. It's been going on for some time now and again on this program as well, and I'm sure in all of our future programs as well. So thank you very much. And our next speaker is Ms. Elizabeth Ezra, Ms. Liz Ezra. And Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker, and she's program coordinator here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra is going to present Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague and friend, Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am very happy to be part of this important call today. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with bladder cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer can affect a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and the psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections can lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers both a general patient telephone group and online support group. Cancer Care can also provide some financial assistance for transportation expenses. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit us at our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we have learned from today's programs, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask or to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Ezra. That was wonderful, and just a wonderful resource as well for everybody on the call. So you have, if ever on the call, you have two wonderful resources on both the BCAN, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and Cancer Care. And between the two of them, you definitely, and of course all the other organizations as well, but you do have tremendous resources to access to get help. And now we do have lots of time for questions. I would want to thank our speakers for that being possible. So I'm going to ask Nicole to bring all of our speakers on board. And actually, if Nicole would please go ahead and explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, I will then, at the end of the call, explain to all of you how to get your questions answered that you might still have or think of tomorrow or the next day. So, Nicole.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web, you may submit a question by asking a question. Again, if you have a question at this time, please press star and then the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
Well, thank you. And there is a question in front of our online participants, and this question is for Dr. Shah. And the question is, what is the risk of the cancer returning? Are there signs and symptoms I should watch for? So that's obviously that's a kind of personal question, but if there's a way that you can answer that in a general way, that the person asking the question as well as everyone on the call can be aware of, that would be, I think, just guidelines
sure.
would be very helpful. Thank you.
Sure. So in dealing with the risk of cancer recurrence, we really sort of think about it in two categories. And one is the risk of local recurrence versus the risk of distant recurrence. And so basically for local recurrence, the things that we advise patients to watch for very closely are things like bleeding from the urine, changes in urinary habits, pain with urination. So those are sort of the local symptoms that people might feel if there's something sort of recurring after they've had a, you know, small tumor resected or something like that. In terms of the risk of distant recurrence, that really is a higher risk scenario when patients have that muscle invasive or metastatic bladder cancer presentation, sort of the higher staging categories. And there, really, what we look for is some symptom that persists over time. So, you know, it's normal for all of us to have knee pain after a long day of running around at work or a headache after a long day. So something that persists is really what we're looking for. So some kind of abdominal pain or some sort of new bony ache and pain that's really persistent and bothersome. We look for changes in weight, fevers and chills that won't abate. We look for suddenly feeling much, much more fatigued than baseline. Something where somebody might develop nausea or vomiting or shortness of breath that persists. So those are sort of some of the things we ask our patients to keep an eye out for.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we have another question from our online participants. The question is, how will this treatment, this is for Dr. Shah, how will this treatment affect my, will I be able to work, exercise, and perform my usual activities?
Perfect. I'll ask in, I'll answer in sort of a general way. It really sort of depends on what's being planned. So for patients that, for example, for localized, let's take localized bladder cancer, you know, there's a relatively short period of time, say roughly 3 or 4 months, where you're undergoing chemotherapy followed by a potential plan for surgery. That's the most common scenario. And some of my patients continue to work full-time on chemotherapy, you know, are out for a couple weeks after surgery and then back to it. Some patients really end up having to take the full time off for the 3 months and then, you know, a couple months, you know, up to surgery and thereafter and are sort of on leave from work. So everybody is very different it depends a little bit on which therapies you're undergoing. Some of the immunotherapies are really generally pretty well-tolerated where people don't necessarily need to take time off work. No matter what, for any surgical intervention, you're going to need time to recover, so you should anticipate time off for that. But it really sort of just depends on an individual's tolerance.
Excellent. Thank you. And we now have a question from one of our people on the phone. So if Nicole, if you could have that question asked. Thank you.
And our first question comes from the line of Yvonne B. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling on behalf of my husband. I would thank you so much for this program. My husband has a question. He has the urothelial carcinoma, papillary urothelial carcinoma.
I'm sorry, could you, are you on speakerphone? We're having a little trouble hearing you. Could you go off speakerphone?
Wait a minute, hold on a minute. Yeah, it's the way I can speak with the phone. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Okay, yes.
Okay. My husband has had this for about a year, and he's been on a more natural protocol, like a naturopathic. And the doctor said when he removed these last tumors that he used some kind of a light. What is the light called, Fred?
A narrow band
imaging, and he said that his bladder walls are 60 to 70% covered with cancer cells. Now, that's too much to remove, and he wants them to go on chemo, and like the other doctors were saying, excuse me, and we want to know, have you guys ever heard of that? They tell you every time they've removed the cancer, it's still cancerous with the biopsies, but now the whole bladder wall by using this light is 60 to 70% all over, and they didn't know that before, which seemed more hopeful than now. And he says, there's too much cancer. It can't be removed. Your only treatment is, it is to keep doing, do chemo and all that other stuff. And now they want him to do the gemo.
So your question is?
My question is, when that happens, when they use this light, and then they say, well, it's not just two tumors. Now your whole bladder is full of cancer. What are your options then? Do you just go to the chemo?
Okay, well, thank you. That's an excellent question in terms of when there's a lot of tumors in the bladder. Dr. Shah, again, if you could address this in a general way, and then, of course, we'll have our caller, of course, go back to our treating healthcare team. And we appreciate both the caller on the call and her spouse also on the call so that we could get a fuller picture of the question. But nevertheless, Dr. Shah, if you could address it in a general way and some helpful guidelines for our caller, that would be helpful, I think.
Sure. So, I'm not a urologist. I'm a medical oncologist, so I deal more with the chemo end of things, although I interact with the surgeons on a daily basis about sort of getting patients safely to surgery. And so I'm not familiar with sort of the particular light that you mentioned. It may be something that's commonly used. I'm just not familiar with it because I don't do the procedures and I'm not a urologist. And so that piece I would advise you to talk with your professional, your doctor about. The other part of the question, though, was sort of when there's multiple sites of involvement in the bladder, you're right that in general terms, it's harder to treat that with just localized therapy because if there is tumor sort of involving different areas of the bladder, it's harder to get all of it by simple resection. So the idea behind pursuing chemotherapy in that setting is because it goes intravenously, it's going all over. So it's hitting any areas that are involved, hopefully, and so that you can get response in multiple areas in a situation where we can't just target one little spot that might be involved.
So that actually, could you say a bit more about then the chemotherapy, immunotherapy, the treatments that would then be more systemic and then actually help the entire, this whole process of having multiple lesions, is that what you're saying?
Correct. So if this is just still localized just to the bladder, there would not be a role for immunotherapy in this situation right now. It would be really traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. Immunotherapy is really only used in what I mentioned as the metastatic setting where the cancer cells have gotten outside the bladder to other areas in the body.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks. And I hope that's been helpful, and I hope you'll then go back to your treating, to your healthcare team, to your urologist about the light, what that means, and also if you also help you to understand what your physician's talking about. And if indeed the decision is to go with a more cytotoxic chemotherapy, could you say a word about the management of side effects? Since I know that's often an issue for people, and there have been so many improvements in how these things are managed, and yet the public often perceives these as not being
right.
manageable. So if
yeah,
you could say something
about that. Yeah, I think this is a really important topic, and in my clinic we spend, anytime we first meet a patient, we actually spend a lot of time discussing this exact issue because, you know, people just get so scared when they hear the word chemotherapy. It's a terrifying word, and, you know, I can personally and professionally attest to that fact, that people hear that word and sort of freeze up. But I'm here to sort of allay some of those concerns because most of the side effects we do have techniques to help manage. So the number one thing that we worry about with cytotoxic chemotherapies is the risk for infection. So as the chemotherapy kills cancer cells, it also kills some of your natural cells, including white blood cells, hemoglobin, which is your, it affects your marrow's ability basically to sort of, your red blood cells, which are your hemoglobin and your platelets. And your marrow, your bone marrow will recover and start producing those cells again, but during chemotherapy you are at risk for infection during those times that your white cells are low. So a lot of chemotherapies are given with a shot called Neulasta, or basically not necessarily that specific one, but other shots that help boost up the white count so that the amount of time that your immune system is compromised is shorter. So that's one thing that your provider may offer you is a patch or an injection or something to help boost that white count up more quickly. During the time that your white count is low, I advise people to be very careful not to be around other people that are sick. So, you know, protect yourself. Don't be around someone that's coughing and cold. Now, I don't want patients to feel like they have to be hermits either. You know, you can go to the grocery store, you can go out to eat, but just be smart about it. Don't be in a crowded place. Keep a mask on hand so that if someone is near you that you didn't anticipate being sick, you can protect yourself with a mask. Now, in terms of the other blood counts going down, like hemoglobin or platelets, those are easy fixes. If it gets to the point where somebody's quite symptomatic, we can always give a blood transfusion or a platelet transfusion if needed, although that's not that common that we have to do so. In terms of nausea and vomiting, which is another big one people worry about, we're pretty aggressive with giving medications IV prior to the chemotherapy even starting. So when you show up for an infusion, you'll typically get nausea medicines first, then the infusion will start, and then you will actually go home with bottles of nausea medicines that you can take. And I usually send home, depending on the regimen, send home patients with a couple different options. And so if you're having a particularly bad day, what I tell patients is take something around the clock. Take something every 6 or 8 hours, no matter what, just to kind of keep it under control, and then you can take something else in between if needed. But when nausea gets hard to control is when people don't take anything proactively, and it sort of can then sort of spiral out of control. Appetite changes are another big concern on chemotherapy. People find as they get into the routine of chemo that they'll know which days are kind of good and bad for them. So typically the first week of chemo might be a little harder, and then the second week people start to feel better. And so what I tell patients is if there's a day you really just don't feel like eating, it becomes a little bit more of a job than a pleasure, but don't force yourself to the point of, you know, vomiting to try and eat something. Just do the best you can. Try and get a couple, you know, small, frequent meals in throughout the day, and then as you start to feel better in the following week, try and make up for it and eat a little bit more, or grab an extra snack. You may notice that certain things you used to love eating don't taste quite as good and vice versa. And so just sort of listen to your body in terms of what feels good to eat. We always recommend, you know, a diet that's heavy in fruits and vegetables, leaner cuts of meat, but basically everything in moderation in terms of your eating habits. Sometimes patients will get mouth sores on chemotherapy. I give patients a really simple home remedy to try and prevent that. What I have them do is just take a cup of warm water, half a teaspoon of salt, half a teaspoon of baking soda, and swish that around your mouth and spit it out at least 4 or 5 times a day. So every time you go to the bathroom and wash your hands, just remember to do that little swish and spit out, and it really helps to kill the bacteria in your mouth, protect the lining of your mouth so that you can prevent mouth sores. You do lose your hair with chemotherapy. That grows back once chemotherapy is complete. fatigue is probably the other biggest one that people face. And usually people aren't laid up in bed all day, but you might feel 60 or 70% of your usual energy. The best thing to do in those scenarios is really try and push yourself a little bit to get up, walk around, go outside, get some fresh air, get some sunshine. Even if it's just for 5 minutes, it will help you feel more energetic than lying in bed or on the couch all day.
Thank you so much. And that actually is so very different than it used to be. People were just told to sleep all day, and now people are told to move around as much as possible. That's kind of a major shift for many people to hear that. I can say something about that, just that how the movement seems to be, how that works, or why that is important. Dr. Shah, if you could say something about why the walking or moving around is important.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that part. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. inertia persists. And so when we're fatigued, the last thing we want to do is get up and walk around. But the more we lay around, the more we lay around, right? I think we're all guilty of that, like when Netflix is on and you watch one and then you watch 10. This is the same thing with motion. If you just kind of break the cycle, get up, walk around, you maintain your muscle strength, you prevent muscle atrophy, you get those endorphins pumping so you feel brighter, more energetic, more happy.
And along those lines, a question from another one of our online participants. Will we be able to walk and climb stairs during home recovery? And I'm assuming this might be someone who actually lives in a home where they need to walk upstairs, or just walking upstairs in general. There are stairs all over the place. So if you could say something about that concept of just adapting to that.
Sure. So typically, yes, patients are fine to get around the house, walk upstairs and downstairs on, chemotherapy or immunotherapy. The one exception to that is if you've had major abdominal surgery, the surgeon may advise that, for a 1 week period of time that you take it easier, and that may be a very specific scenario. But other than that, no typical issues with getting up and downstairs on therapy.
Excellent. Okay. And with another question from one of our online participants, so how do treatments vary or differ between a person with high-grade early-stage bladder cancer and versus a person with low-grade advanced bladder cancer? So it's kind of a general question.
Okay. Good question. So it's a little bit tricky to make a global statement about this because there are just so many small variables we look at in any one treatment decision. If someone has advanced cancer, meaning cancer in the muscle, in the lymph nodes, elsewhere in the body, the low-grade piece does not matter that much. We treat, because that cancer has spread to another area and is advanced, we would treat, sort of full court press if the patient was a candidate despite that low-grade terminology. The high-grade terminology is an interesting thing to look at. Now, this is a minor deviation from bladder cancer, but I think it'll speak to the exact point that I'm trying to make, which is that in the upper tract cancers, which involve the ureter or even the renal pelvis, which is the part of the kidney that feeds right into the ureters where your urine drains into the ureters, even if someone doesn't have disease that's invading, into the muscle tissue, if it's high grade, we think, okay, this is a little bit more risky, it's behaving a little more aggressively, and therefore we ought to consider chemotherapy or whatever therapy more strongly. So in isolation, high grade isn't enough to warrant any particular treatment, but sort of taken in context with what the rest of the situation is, it does suggest that perhaps these cells are a little more aggressively growing and may need higher level of intervention.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question. So what does follow-up for bladder cancer treatment look like from one of our online participants?
Again, that will depend a little bit on the exact scenario. If somebody is actively on treatment, say they're actively on chemotherapy, typically we're seeing patients once a week or once every other week. So it's a lot of, checking in, making sure symptoms are being managed, making sure the therapy is going well. So you get your chemo on a Monday. Well, the following Monday I'd want to see you in clinic to check in, make sure everything's fine. Once patients are done with their initial treatment, and they're on to what we call a surveillance phase, really they're following up just every couple months, so every 3 months or even spaced out further than that as time goes on. So it sort of depends on where you are and how intense the therapy is.
And then our last late-breaking question, well, this will be our last question then for Dr. Shah. It really has to do with genetic testing. So so the question is, you know, should my children be tested, family members, if I have bladder cancer?
So that's a really excellent question, actually. We look at a number of factors when we decide whether to refer a patient to genetic counseling or not. Traditionally speaking, if someone presents at a very young age, then yes, definitely they're a candidate. You know, if ages 50, 55 and less, if they present with bladder cancer, I send them to see a genetic counselor to get tested, and based on that testing, we can decide if family members need to be tested. Bladder cancer does not carry the same familial risk that certain other cancers do, like breast and ovarian cancer. However, we're learning more and more about particular sort of inheritance patterns. I would say the vast, vast majority of bladder cancers in this country are actually smoking related. So they're not necessarily genetic predispositions, but rather environmental issues like smoking. Internationally, there are also certain infections that cause bladder cancer. So those aren't genetic links. They're really more environmental exposures. However, we had a recent, just earlier this month, we had our big national cancer conference, and there was some really interesting data presented on the fact that there are probably higher rates of genetic risk for bladder cancer than we've previously realized. So in my practice, anybody who presents with an upper tract urothelial cancer, meaning in the renal pelvis or ureter, I'm sending off a sort of initial screen for certain genetic issues that might be going on. For true bladder cancer, if they present with a young age or have a strong family history where other people in the family have had cancers, then I will send off bladder cancer, I should say, or certain other cancers that we think are linked, then I will send them to genetic counseling as well. But it's not something that we do across all comers for bladder cancer because most of the time, like I said, we think they're related to smoking or other exposures.
Excellent. Wow, that's excellent. Thank you so much. This, I have to say, has been an amazing call. I really have to thank Dr. Shah and Dr. Chisholm and Ms. Ezra. This has been just an incredible call, lots of information, a lot of wonderful questions that really enhance the call. So, and a lot of you listening as well, of course. And so I can't thank you all enough for and our speakers can't hear us applauding them, but we are, and actually, particularly want to call out to Dr. Shah because it really was quite a tour de force of presenting on everything we could think of. And I know there are more questions, so let me get to that because I had said to you I would let you know how to get your questions answered. So the first place I would certainly recommend that you call, because we've just heard so much about the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and many of you are familiar with this organization, and certainly to call them at 1-888-901-BCAN. Or www.bcan.org. It's a wonderful resource. And you'll be getting an evaluation after today's program. And in the evaluation will be all the resources that we suggest that you contact in terms of. So that's a wonderful resource. I also often recommend the National Cancer Institute as a general place to go to for questions that you may have. They have a toll-free number, 1-800-422-6237, or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And what they do have, a very interesting live chat feature where you can post your question, and one of their information specialists will really research it for you to try to get you all the answers that you need. So that that can be very helpful as well. Of course, you have all the other organizations that we're partnering with on today's program as well. However, if you're interested in pursuing either practical and financial assistance from cancer care or counseling services or joining a support group, either a telephone or online support group, or signing up for future programs or actually participating in any one of our other programs that we have here, or indeed visiting our website, then I would suggest you contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Perhaps the most important takeaway from this program, in addition to everything you've heard from our speakers, and I do want to also say that your healthcare team, of course, is a reference for all of you to have as well. You definitely want to take anything back to your healthcare team that you learn. Always run things past your healthcare team. That's really so important. They are vitally important to your day-to-day care. There's no question about that. But we don't want any one of you to feel you're alone. I want you to now feel that you're connected to lots of resources, Cancer Care being one of them, BCAN, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network being another one of them, and then all the other organizations as well that we've listed and you'll be getting information about. So in those moments when you feel alone or that you feel like you just really don't quite know what to do, you have a lot of free resources that you can contact. And in this instance, I don't think the more cooks, they do not spoil the brew. In other words, the more people you contact, it's okay in this instance, because sometimes people just, you really need to talk to somebody, and sometimes you need to try different places to find the right fit for you. And we know that we work with many people who use both our services and other organization services as well, and find it to be very helpful in those moments when they just feel like, I just need somebody to talk to. I should also call out to the fact that the American Cancer Society has a 24-hour call center 365 days a year. So that's a wonderful place to call when you're kind of in the middle of the night, wherever you are, and need to speak to someone. And their number is 1-800-227-2345 or www.cancer.org. And again, you'll get all those resources from us. So they're basically, there's someone for you at any time of the day or night to some extent, and including your healthcare team. So I want to thank you all for your participation today. I do want to let you all know a program that we're doing that's a little bit different. It's called What Are Generic Drugs? Understanding the Role in Cancer Treatment. That will take place on Thursday, June 29th from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And for those of you who haven't signed up for it yet and might be interested, please do go ahead and sign up for it. And thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.